ICER is the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review. I'm Jeff Stewart from Syneos Health Consulting. I met with Leslie Eisenegger at a conference to figure out what pharma companies need to know about ICER. ICER, the frenemy of the people, next on the Syneos Health Podcast. Leslie Eisenegger, welcome to the Syneos Health Podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So we're talking today about ICER. I don't think I know what ICER is. What is ICER?
ICER is a third-party independent review organization started a few years ago. And ICER really began its review process looking at clinical interventions. They look at cost effectiveness. And so they looked at clinical interventions and some devices, and probably about 2015, they moved to looking at pharmaceuticals. So the vast majority of the reviews they've done in the last few years are really looking at the cost effectiveness and comparative effectiveness of different pharmaceuticals for different disease categories.
What does ICER mean?
It's the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review.
So is this an official government organization, or is this something that's more akin to guidelines?
They are not a government organization. They are independently funded. They have advisory boards. Some pharmaceutical companies do participate with them and serve in an advisory capacity. And a lot of their funding also comes from payer organizations as well.
When we think about something like if you have your credit card, you need to get your credit back in line, you end up getting help from a credit bureau that helps you. But sometimes they're funded by the credit card companies and not really on your side. They're there to make sure the credit card companies get funded. I'm a little scared when I hear something that is funded by a payer.
That has been a major criticism of ICERs. Their independence is often challenged because of their relationship with payers. And I guess I should say that the vast majority of their funding seems to come from the John and Laura Arnold Foundation, which is an independent charitable foundation that really looks at innovation across a variety of industries, not healthcare, but they're a primary benefactor of ICERs as well.
So is ICER really the frenemy, the friend, or the enemy of the pharmaceutical companies?
I think we can say frenemy. That's probably pretty accurate. I think ICER's looking for its version of the truth in value. But I think value is in the eye of the beholder. Value changes based on what data you have available and what inputs you use. And so certainly, ICER tends to come out looking at innovation, because we don't have a lot of the real world evidence to back it up, as overvalued. And I think most pharmaceutical companies, having spent many, many years trying to develop innovative therapies, would tell you that they're every day trying to change lives for patients, and the medicines that they're putting out there are worth the money that are being asked for them. And I think ICER adds another layer of complexity. Certainly, every manufacturer has to negotiate with a variety of different public and private payers to get drugs on formulary. So ICER just brings that one more process that publicly plays out that adds new challenges to pharmaceutical manufacturers getting drugs into the hands of patients that need them.
And nobody likes being graded by someone who won't tell you how they're grading you.
That is absolutely correct. I think that is one of the biggest criticisms of the entire process. It's gotten a little less opaque over time, but still the actual analysis is not made publicly available. Some manufacturers have even asked ICER to kind of create some sort of input formula that they can download and look at the numbers and see if they can arrive at the same analysis or the same outcomes that ICER does. And ICER considers that sort of its proprietary property. So that's not fully available. And so it makes it really difficult to understand how they're making their choices and what assumptions they ultimately make.
Okay, so pharma is still nonetheless participating in ICER, it sounds like.
Yes, they do. They participate in a membership capacity, but also they will announce specific disease category reviews. So they're saying, we're going to look at medicines for asthma or diabetes or ovarian cancer. And so the pharmaceutical companies that make products that fall into that category are asked to participate in the review.
Okay, so the review happens at launch? Or is this at any time in the product lifecycle? Is anyone subject to potential ICER review?
I think the answer to that is yes. The timeline has really been changing. You know, when ICER first started reviewing pharmaceuticals, they were looking at chronic condition, like large populations. So they looked at diabetes, asthma, and hepatitis C. So when those vaccines launched, that was one of the big reviews they did. Lately, they've been moving more into looking at investigational medicines and also looking at more rare disease. So they've shifted over time to what they're looking at. One of the big questions that I think they look to answer is, you know, how are we spending our healthcare dollars and are we getting the best outcomes? So I think in some ways they're following the money. You know, they first were looking at impacts on large disease that affected a great number of people and were chronic conditions. So you would be taking medicines over your lifetime. Now they're really kind of shifting into the more precision health, high dollar medicines that we're seeing that are even more revolutionary. There's an ocular gene therapy that's coming to market that they're looking at, and they announced that they're going to look at the CAR Ts. So they're starting to look at that more gene therapy, precision medicine bent.
The ICER review, at the end of the day, it presents whether or not something's cost effective. At what price something should be sold? Is that what they're basically coming down to?
Basically, it has a variety of factors in the review, and the review is a multi-stage process. So there are a number of milestones across an ICER review. ICER doesn't say we're going to do a review and then 6 months later just come out with a report. They try to function where they have public comment periods. So they'll announce a scoping document draft to say this is what we're going to review and how a little bit. And people are allowed to weigh into that, both the pharmaceutical companies that may be in the review, but also advocacy groups and other interested stakeholders can weigh in. They'll send a revised scoping document having potentially taken in some of that feedback. And then they do a couple of passes at the evidence report of how they've reviewed these medicines and why. They look at comparative effectiveness of the drugs. They've started to look at other factors, so the more intangible things that are important to patients and caregivers. Although I think ICER would say that that's still an imperfect science for them. And then they also evaluate the cost effectiveness. So they actually assess a number. They use QALYs, so quality adjusted life years. So what would a medicine cost if you had a year of perfect health? And they value at $50,000 per QALY, $100,000 per QALY, and their maximum threshold right now is $150,000 per QALY. So if you got 1 year of perfect health back for using this drug, the max that we should pay for it as a society is $150,000. And then they give discount rates based on the WAC prices that they use, the list prices of the medicines, not counting any discounts or negotiations that manufacturers may have with payers at this point, but just the list price. And so they give an assessment of what discount off of that price is necessary to fall in the $150,000 per QALY level.
Okay, so QALYs are the case where lower is better. If something costs less to give you a year of quality life,
that's correct.
It's fantastic.
Yes, that's correct.
Something that costs $1,000 to give you a year of quality life, that would be incredible.
Right, right. And, you know, that also depends on the condition as well. I mean, all of these things are adjusted.
Yeah, the quality for removing the appearance of fine lines and wrinkles is going to be very low. I imagine it's going to, you know, to get a whole year worth of health.
Yeah, absolutely.
But something where you are likely to be hospitalized full term for the entire course of the disease, that would be something where one would be willing to pay more. And they've made this barrier of $150,000 per year is the max they will consider.
That's the common threshold that's used. ICER uses that as its threshold. Recently, this summer, ICER held an orphan drug summit where it sort of looked at that question and had a variety of stakeholders look at that question. Do chronic diseases have a different QALY than rare disease? And what should that threshold be for rare and ultra rare disease? And so they're in the process of developing new framework for rare disease drugs, which they qualify as a patient population of 10,000 or less. And they have some different QALY measures around that. They've increased that number a little bit to try to capture the fact that rare disease is very different than chronic disease.
And that's a very different barrier from, say, the standard orphan disease, which I believe is 200,000 patients.
Correct, correct. So it's a much lower standard to meet the threshold for their more, I think, more forgiving framework or broader framework.
So to put that into context, something like lupus, which has more than their 10,000 patient barrier, would probably not be in the realm of being an enhanced payment.
Right. Right.
But something that was very rare, like retinitis pigmentosum, which is one of the genetic causes of blindness, that would be very rare. And so would fall under this potentially higher payment.
Right. You know, things like we've seen for Duchenne's muscular dystrophy and other conditions like that, that we've seen some products come to market very recently, these medicines targeting those rare diseases, those would qualify under ICER's new formula for this more refined framework.
Okay. So ICER's there. ICER's making some kind of judgment. How does a pharmaceutical company help them make the judgment they want? I mean, obviously they want to make the right judgment, but if you're a pharmaceutical company, you want it to be a judgment that's favorable to you. What can you do to help?
I think you can do a few things. ICER has a lot of challenges in that we had done some proprietary research with payers on ICER reviews. You know, how influential are they in developing formularies? And there's research out in the world that suggests that 60% of payers use ICER reviews to help them influence formulary decision making. But what we've seen is that's a little bit more of a mixed bag. Payers create their own formularies, and that helps that are proprietary to their network. And some of that is the value that they bring to their membership. So sort of blindly following someone else's guidelines eliminates a little bit of their competitive advantage. So the payers I spoke with were not particularly interested in just following the same formulary as everyone else. The other challenge is that ICER uses largely publicly available data. So they're looking at earliest, the randomized clinical trial right before approval. So they may start their review when a medicine is still in an investigational state, but they can't start it too early. And payers, they're having conversations about formulary development and making coverage decisions almost concurrently or ahead of when some of these ICER reviews can come out. So ICER is not necessarily helping them, according to a lot of the payers that we spoke to in our research. And that makes it challenging for ICER to have a huge impact because they're only working with limited data. Now, that said, to answer your question about what can pharmaceutical companies do, it's really how you're interpreting this data that's available. And as ICER tries to review medicines earlier and earlier in the process, it's having to make more and more assumptions about the data. Recently, ICER reviewed the PARP inhibitors for ovarian cancer, which is really groundbreaking treatment for women with recurrent ovarian cancer. All three of the medicines that are available in that space have really shown pretty significant progression-free survival for women. And what we saw is that ICER was making assumptions on overall survival and trying to fit it into its quality model, but it didn't have that data. So a lot of it was assumption. And I think the manufacturers were saying, well, you're making a pretty significant assumption of effectiveness and cost when you're using a lot of your own assumptions and you're not fully sharing how you're arriving at your numbers, and they don't sync up with the numbers we have if we make those same assumptions. So really, it becomes a question of data and continually updating the data to show value. The manufacturers that I've worked with who are going through ICER reviews, they're making the case with their own data, certainly. And then I think the other thing that's really important is patients want to have a chance with these new medicines. And so when innovative medicines come to market, we don't have a whole battery of real-world data that we can rely on to see how effective it is and how effective it is for a variety of different patients who may have different clinical challenges, complex clinical conditions beyond the one that's being treated by that medicine. So patients are really starting to come to these reviews and participate more aggressively, saying that they want the opportunity to have access to these medicines.
When you're a pharmaceutical company and you're going to a payer to make an economic argument, in the U.S. at least, it's a hard discussion.
Sure, sure.
Having been there, it's a hard discussion because they don't generally believe you when you bring, say, your computer model and they say, well, I've never seen any of these that are ever anything, but this drug is amazing and saves me millions of dollars. Is ICER open to having these discussions, or are they just as closed or more closed than payers are?
Well, interestingly enough, at this recent ovarian cancer public meeting, when the point was brought up, this review is too premature, we don't have the right kind of data, a representative from ICER did say, well, payers are having these conversations right now, whether we like it or not. So at least we're having this in a public forum and we have a variety of voices around the table. And to a certain extent, I think that's right. I think the bigger question, and ICER is just one organization trying to answer this, but the bigger question or problem that we're facing is I think we are innovating far more quickly than we can figure out how to pay for any of this.
Yeah, true.
And some of that might be actual dollars, but some of it's just the way our system works. When we're looking at drug spend is one sector of the healthcare system. And a drug that may look expensive compared to what came before it, we're not evaluating that based on how many hospitalizations that can save over a patient's lifetime. And so that's the bigger question. And I think that question is really starting to come to the fore now that we're looking at more of the gene therapy approach, where you can suppress a disease or maybe even eradicate its manifestation over a period of time with one treatment. And we're still trying to track. Obviously, we need a lot of data to see the durability of those therapies. But when you think about a disease like hemophilia that could cost several hundred thousand dollars a year to treat, and people are coming to market with gene therapies to address that in kind of one shot, I mean, how much is that actually worth to the entire system? Payers have to base their actuarial accounting on kind of a year at a time based on the beneficiaries they will have in their plan. And it doesn't account for the fact that you might be saving someone down the road really significant medical conditions. Hepatitis C is the classic example of that. Taking a drug now that seems very expensive to avoid a transplant that could be millions of dollars later seems like a pretty good deal, but our system isn't set up to really accommodate that. If anything, I think ICER is shining a little bit of light on that, but I think the challenge with ICER is it comes out with these numbers that says medicines are overvalued.
Overpriced.
Well, overvalued. They are overpriced for what they're delivering.
Okay.
And if that's the case, and that's kind of the takeaway, that's really challenging to the system. That limits patient access. It in some ways limits the potential for innovation in the future. And that's what we have to be careful about. I recently wrote a blog for Pharmaceutical Executive looking at this based on ICER's Orphan Drug Summit. And I work in the reputation and risk management practice. And so we are really looking at how the public reacts to some of these reviews. So the media and advocates, and to a certain extent, policymakers. And we've seen declining media coverage of ICER reviews over time. I think partially because the reviews themselves are complex. The methodology has changed a lot. And we right now don't have any kind of governmental mandate to use these. So even though it's a public process, it's still a lot of inside baseball, behind the scenes analysis. But patients are legitimately worried that these headlines of these drugs are overvalued, these drugs are overpriced, they're not worth it, is really going to limit their access to them. And when you're a patient or you're the caregiver of a patient, and it means the difference between you taking a drug at home versus having to drive 4 hours for an infusion or whatever it may be, I mean, these are life-changing decisions for individual patients. So I think the challenge is, how do we have this discourse without creating a threat to access for patients who really need this medicine?
Well, how do we do that? I think that, as we've discussed here, there are a couple things that come to my mind. The payer has a fundamentally different relationship with ICER from what it has with something like NCCN, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, because a payer is forced in some states to adhere to that, to allow drugs that are on these cancer guidelines are specifically then named in different states and saying, you must cover these drugs, even if they're not approved for the condition,
right,
even if they're not otherwise would have been on your formulary. Yes, you must cover those drugs. That's not true for ICER, it sounds like.
No, it's not true for ICER.
So ICER becomes, instead of the best friend of pharma, possibly a bad enemy if it's used against you from the payer side, but also possibly your friend in that other case, the case where you do have value that's split across something like medical benefit and pharmacy benefit. In the case of the liver transplant is on the medical benefit side. The HCV drugs are on the pharmacy benefit side. And if you are only concerned about the pharmacy benefit side, well, you know, as a payer, you may not care so much about the fact that a liver transplant costs $300,000 or whatever a liver transplant costs. ICER can be the friend of the pharma company, it sounds like, in those cases.
Well, I think it goes back to that question of how our system looks at healthcare costs. Certainly, one of the challenges for payers is that cost avoidance 10 years into the future, potentially, if that beneficiary no longer is in your plan, you're saving money for someone else. And so that's a challenge as well. So I think if anything, these conversations are helping us rethink our system, but our system is woefully behind what we can do on the innovation front. ICER definitely, I think that they're still considered pretty adversarial or look to be pretty adversarial. And certainly having your medicine challenged with data, there doesn't necessarily exist head-to-head trials on a lot of these medicines. ICER is extrapolating that information, looking at a lot of different data from different trials and kind of making those comparisons. And it's a challenge for manufacturers to have to come and respond to this when ICER's own calculations are not made public. I mean, that's been one of the things manufacturers have been asking ICER to do, is at least release to them what the formula looks like and what assumptions they're making so that they could replicate ICER's review process and better understand how they're arriving at their assessments. But to this date, ICER considers that part of their proprietary advantage. And so they keep that close to the vest, although they certainly work with manufacturers throughout the review process. To your question, can ICER help you? Can ICER hurt you? It really depends. But what it's been doing lately is, I think, really raising questions of access. Because if anything, even if payers aren't using the ICER reviews to make formulary decisions, certainly they can use them to point to a public source to support a lot of restrictions, prior authorization requirements, perhaps even step edits. And that becomes very challenging, both for manufacturers who are really looking to get their medicines into the hands of patients who need them, and patients who really see a lot of this innovative medicine as their new lifeblood and gives them new hope.
If a payer can reach to clinical trial data that are referenced within the label, they can and will in some cases if they want to. It sounds like ICER also provides them the handle, the way to think about it, the handle that they can grab to now pick up the tool of, yes, I want to keep these patients to a particular clinical trial standard. I now know why I want to, because I believe the price is too high, because ICER said so. So in this world, what does a pharma company do?
Well, I also think ICER is not the only voice here. As you mentioned, NCCN develops its own evidence guidelines. And the interesting thing about an NCCN versus an ICER is NCCN is constantly updating. So they certainly will, anytime a new evidence comes out, a new trial, a new paper, they will incorporate that automatically into their process. That's something that ICER has struggled with and has just started to do. ICER had looked at reports sort of as a one-off. So we're going to look at the PCSK9s. We're going to look at asthma medicines. We're going to look at this. And then they would do the review over that period of time based on the evidence they had and kind of move on to their next category. One of the criticisms that had been levied at them has been, well, evidence is changing all of the time. So what happens when we have new evidence come out, but that's the standing ICER review? And so ICER recently has tried to start updating its reviews based on new clinical evidence. And we've only seen that once. They did it for PCSK9s, but we expect them to start doing that a little bit more to keep their reviews fresh and consistent with the trial data and other evidence, real-world evidence that's coming available. And so certainly that's something manufacturers have been able to do. I think some of these criticisms, it's not just manufacturers don't like ICER's conclusions, it's that they feel like they're not representing the whole story. And so I think ICER has heard some of that and has certainly tried to respond in the ways that it can. I think it's very imperfect, but they've really, over the last, I would say, 6 months, changed a few things about their reviews that had been really hot button issues for pharma companies in the past. And that's one of them, to stay more current with data that's available.
I think we'll end with just one final question. ICER has a big black box. It's hard to know how to influence that black box. Sounds like you can bring them data. Are there other influencers that we should be bringing data and stories to? Even if they don't listen to us as a pharmaceutical company, are there other people who will advocate on our behalf?
Absolutely. I think the best advocates we have are doctors and patients. And that's something we've started to see in these ICER reviews more and more. Advocacy groups coming and speaking at the public meetings that ICER has, submitting comments during the public comment period. I attribute a lot of the changes that ICER's made in the last 6 months to a year to that kind of feedback, where you have patients saying, well, this is all well and good, but this new medicine allows me, as I used the example earlier, if I can inject at home, I don't have to drive to an infusion center. I don't have to take a day off from work. My loved one doesn't have to take a day off from work to drive me. That changes our lives. And so some of those innovations that really facilitate quality of life for patients, those were not being incorporated in these reviews. And of course, they're difficult to measure, and that's the challenge. But I think patients are really starting to bring that to the fore. The ovarian cancer meeting, there were a number of survivors there representing advocacy organizations who were saying the difference with this drug, maybe 6 months of additional life, doesn't fit into the QALY model, but that allows me to see my child graduate from high school, to see my child get married, to help plan for my children's future. Those intangibles are the things that need to be better integrated in these types of reviews. Certainly that point of view is critical. And then I think the challenge for groups like ICER is to really be thinking more systemically. This isn't just a pharmaceutical sector issue. This is, where are we spending our dollars? Are we spending them with pharmaceuticals? Are we spending them in the hospital? Are we spending them to treat chronic illness? Are we spending them in prevention? That gets increasingly complicated. You know, our healthcare system has to meet the needs of so many different kinds of patients. So you have the young invincibles who really don't access the healthcare system very much at all. You might have a person in their mid-40s who have a number of chronic conditions they're trying to manage from getting worse. You have some people who've never really had a consistent touch point with the healthcare system or consistent insurance who are enrolling in Medicare. And then they suddenly are diagnosed with a number of conditions that could have been prevented earlier in life. And then you have people who are born with the rare diseases. What pharma is able to do for them is really bringing them new hope, new life, and changing their entire quality of life. And our system has to accommodate all of those people. And so I think, if anything, these analyses, while challenging and imperfect, are really helping us understand a little bit better what is innovation, what is value. And the one warning I would have is, I think we can't walk away with any of these one assumptions as the total story. And that's something that I think ICER needs to be careful about. I think people reading ICER reviews need to be careful about. It's not just that one story. There's a lot of data, and we should be collecting data over time. And as we get more evidence, we'll understand better the implications and the benefits of this innovation. But that's really the lesson here, is how are we thinking about our system differently? And ICER is providing sort of one way to look at that, but I don't think they're the sole arbiter of value in medicine. Certainly not.
Leslie Eisen, thanks so much for being on the Syneos Health Podcast.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
That's all for today's episode of the Syneos Health Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Stewart from Syneos Health Consulting. If you have comments, suggestions, questions, or if you just want to talk to a particular challenge that you have at your life sciences company, you may email me at podcast@syneoshealth.com. That's SyneosHealth.com. We're consultants. That's what we do.